Join me, Rick Howe, on Island Music for the finest in ska, rocksteady, roots reggae, dub and sizzling dancehall, and all the hottest releases from around the Pacific.
Hi, I'm Ronnie Kareni from Sorong Samurai, and you're listening to Island Music.
Hi everyone, my name is Tieni from Te Tangi o Te Kara, and you're listening to Island Music.
Search up ABC Island Music to listen online or find it on the ABC Listen app.
This is an ABC podcast.
Talofa, Marlo, Bulavanaka and good morning. This is Pacific Beats on ABC Radio Australia. It's Tuesday, December 23. I'm Kyle Evans and thanks for tuning in wherever you are around the Pacific. Only 2 days until Christmas now, but it's been a chaotic festive season in Papua New Guinea with flight delays forcing travellers to sleep on the floor.
Women and children and everyone who are travelling, lying all, you know, hungry, starving, and it almost was very stressful for them.
Also, new figures show an increased number of dark fleet tankers sailing under Pacific flags, and a bid to establish a Polynesian-owned club in the NRL steps up. All that and more today on the show. I'm Kyle Evans. Let's get started. But first, the United States is shutting its doors to dozens of countries with the introduction of travel restrictions. President Donald Trump had flagged tougher visa rules when he began his second term. But what's surprising is that from January 1, Tongans will be among those partially banned from getting US visas. Tonga now joins Haiti, Cuba and Venezuela on a list of 39 nations deemed threats to US national security. But how exactly Tonga is a threat is unclear. So to unpack it, we're joined by Henrietta McNeil-Stowers from the Australian National University. Henrietta, welcome to the program.
Morena, good morning, Kyle, and Merry Christmas.
Merry Christmas to you. Now, this ban comes into effect next week. So I guess the big question is, why is Tonga considered a threat to the national security of the United States?
So the United States has not said that Tonga is a direct threat to national security, but they have said that there are issues around the reliability of birth certificate records and other documentation, the amount of data that's being shared between Tonga and the United States, high overstaying rates of people who get visas to be in the US, and refusing to repatriate deportees. Now, I'm not convinced by that last one in particular, because we know that there are over 1,000 people who have been returned from the US to Tonga, the majority of whom are from the US. So some of those numbers and the accuracy of those statements may vary.
Yeah, the deportee issue one is interesting. We'll get to that a little bit later on. But you did mention the overstays. I did actually read the White House's overstay report, and Tonga had an overstay rate of 6.45% for the B1 and B2 visas, and a rate of 14% on the FM and J visas. Now, I'm not quite sure what the differences between those visas are, but are those figures high enough, do you think, to justify a ban like this?
So those final figures you were saying, the 14.4% on F&J visas, that's student and exchange visas. But in general, no. So those rates are comparable with other states that are not subject to the travel ban. So those are not significantly high overstaying rates. We know that there are issues with overstaying rates, but I don't think it's worthy of a travel ban, a complete travel ban.
I see. So I guess it's part of a larger set of issues which the United States has identified. Is that sort of fair to say?
That's how I'm reading the same documents that you're reading, but yes.
Yeah. The 39 countries seem to be split into two groups. On the State Department website, it lists Tonga in the group that will have visa issuance partially suspended. So what do you think that will look like for Tongans when it comes into effect on January 1?
So it's not going to affect Tongans who already have existing visas or have dual citizenship or have green cards, but it will affect people who are applying for new visas, whether that be for tourism, business, study, exchange, and the applications of immediate relatives of US citizens and children adopted abroad. So that's really going to affect people who have family residing in the US. things like family visits will become much harder, especially those who need to travel for funerals, family reunions, church missions, weddings, or who need to travel for periods each year to care for elderly family members.
Mm. And what about those in the US? I mean, the Pacific diaspora community maintains close ties with their homeland, so I assume a travel ban to the US will be felt very hard by that community.
Absolutely. Those people-to-people connections are enormous, and there is a lot of movement between Tonga and the US and backwards and forwards. So it will definitely affect people who are trying to travel to the US and trying to connect with their family members.
You're listening to Pacific Beat on ABC Radio Australia. I'm Kyle Evans, and I'm chatting with Henrietta McNeil Stowers from the Australian National University about US visa bans imposed on Tongan nationals. Now, earlier in the year, Tuvalu and Vanuatu were also expected to be listed, but that's no longer the case, it seems. How did they manage to get off the list, do you think?
Well, it appears that Tuvalu may have been put on that list wrongly, because there was no clear reasoning for why Tuvalu would have been put on there. And I think Vanuatu did a lot of diplomacy to ensure that it was taken off the list. And I think there were some negotiations going on with the US embassy and with other officials in the US. So I think there was a lot of work done during that time to make sure that Vanuatu did not remain on the list. I don't know what happened in the case of Tonga, but it is unfortunate that Tonga still on that list.
Yeah, well, speaking of diplomacy, I mean, what do you think Tonga would need to do to get itself off the ban list? Is diplomacy the answer, or is it accepting deportees potentially?
I mean, Tonga already accepts a large number of deportees, but I think there are probably some conversations that could be had between officials around reliability of records and data sharing. I think diplomacy is a large part of that and the negotiations that go on behind the scenes. Yeah.
And what do you think the implications are on this ban on the US geopolitical situation in the Pacific? Like, surely it will make it tougher for the US to build or renew ties with the Pacific region.
Oh, absolutely. We know that the relationships are the biggest currency of influence in this geopolitical game that's being played. And we know that people-to-people connections are critical to having good relationships between countries. Now, officials don't always think about the span of that and the effect that churches and that families have on those people-to-people relationships. So making it harder for people to travel, for people to do business, will have a huge implication on the reputation of the US. We also know that many Tongans in the diaspora are already fearful of immigration raids. And so there are a lot of concerns about what's going on in the US at the moment for Tongan communities. So it can't be good for the US's reputation.
And you mentioned deportees a second ago, and I know that is one area of your expertise. And like you said, Tonga is a major recipient of deportees from the US. Could Tonga respond to these bans by not accepting deportees potentially as a way to, I'm not sure, like gain leverage in this situation?
So under international law, it would be very difficult for Tonga to not accept its own citizens. But there are things that Tonga can do to ensure that the US is sending people in a way that's appropriate for Tonga. So in places like Samoa, they ask for a lot of family information to assist with the reintegration prior to deportation. And that's one of the kind of delays that Tonga could affect. But in general, I think that's not going to have a huge impact on these particular travel bans.
Yeah, interesting. And I guess more broadly, you know, numerous research has linked deportees to criminal activity in places like Tonga. Have Pacific countries become a dumping ground for convicted US criminals, do you think?
There's certainly a lot of Tongan politicians and church leaders who argue that there is not a lot of support for returnees to Pacific countries, and that the deportation policies are definitely sending people back without any reintegration support, and that is akin to dumping. There are a lot of issues with the reintegration, and the loss of USAID is certainly one of the things that's not assisting in the support of returns.
Yes, it's definitely food for thought, that is for sure. Henrietta, that's all we've got time for this morning, but thank you so much for joining us on Pacific Beat.
Thank you very much. Have a great day.
You too. That was Henrietta McNeil-Stowers, a research fellow at the Department of Pacific Affairs at the Australia National University.
What goes on behind the scenes in Pacific politics and how does it affect us? Polytalk is back to unpack the big questions like, why is no one talking about PNG's political refugee crisis?
I can't even call it an election. It was something like a criminal thug war.
Join me, Scott Whitey, as I chat all things Pacific politics on Polytalk.
Tuesday, 9 a.m. PNG time on ABC Radio Australia or wherever you get your podcasts.
Welcome back to Pacific Beat. Well, it's been a chaotic festive season for air travellers in Papua New Guinea, with delayed flights disrupting travel plans, forcing passengers to sleep at the domestic terminal in Port Moresby. Retired public servant Mensa Wagoon was assisting grieving family members in transit from Leh to Wewak when their casket containing the body of a loved one was delayed in Port Moresby. She told ABC reporter Hilda Wayne that the national carrier needs to suspend further ticket sales until the backlog of passengers are cleared from Port Moresby.
About 7:30, they arrived and the casket was rescheduled with those accompanying the casket twice. And then it got cancelled in the afternoon. And I had to talk to customer service with the widow. And we personally got involved in helping to make sure that the casket was returned to the funeral home in Erima, which is not far from the airport. So anything took care of the casket to the funeral home, but from the funeral home to the airport was a relative responsibility because of protocols at the funeral home. Family member must identify the casket before the funeral home can take it to the airport to have it wait and prepare for the next flight we make.
That must have been really stressful for the family, especially, you know, under those circumstances, trying to take a loved one home. And what was it like for the family members?
Oh, the family members and myself, we all got involved in the first place when they arrived and before they arrived. Very stressful getting out of Leh, as well as in Port Moresby to Wewak. And we went up to Yangaroo in the afternoon, so you know, we manage a lot of stressful situations. The sad thing is, when they arrived in Wewak, they didn't even inform that the casket which they were going to accompany would not come that day, Tuesday afternoon. It would come on Wednesday afternoon. So anything failed to communicate with the girls too in Wewak.
The daughters arrived in Wewak and they had to wait another night again for the casket to come the next day.
That's correct. And then the uncle, his brother, who traveled with them from Leh, he got on a PMV and went up home. And the villagers who came down to pick the casket, accompany the casket, were there. So he got on the PMV and went up to the village to tell the villagers now. So it became more stressful dealing with village people and trying to explain to them what the situation is. And you know, their preparation is also important, and the girls were stranded in Wewak.
And Mensa, going back to Port Moresby and the delay in Port Moresby, apart from yourself and your family members waiting to transit or transfer the casket over home, what other delays were there, especially for other passengers?
The scene was very chaotic because usually the passengers would be outside the terminal and you can physically see them. But during that period, yeah, somehow they allowed everybody, the passengers, including those who are checking them into the check-in terminal. It was all chaotic because anything was mixing up. All the online ticketers, tourists who came in, plus the cash tickets, and most of them were dealing with cash tickets. So passengers decided to sleep inside the check-in area, not outside anymore. But in the past, it was outside. This time they had to go inside. So women and children and everyone who were traveling, including tourists, were inside, lying all, you know, hungry, starving. And it was always very, very stressful for them. So I also happened to go inside and then I saw it with my own eyes.
Are those passengers that were stranded then at the domestic terminal, were they supposed to travel to different provinces from Port Moresby?
Sure. Well, all the planes were transiting from Port Moresby, not Lae. They were all, you know, transiting from Port Moresby, or they were going out of Port Moresby to other centres. And we have 18 provinces or 21 provinces. So all those passengers, including tourists, they landed. And they had to transit from Port Moresby to other centres.
What do you think, in your opinion, is a solution to address this issue?
I think bringing those two, or now they're saying three planes have been brought in, it won't help solve the problem, because the number of passengers in Port Moresby is, you know, just too many. And then when we think of others from the other centres travelling, this peak period, I think three planes will not serve better, because I live along the path, the flight path at Morata, okay, before it lands at the Jacksons. All these planes here are overused. These three planes coming in, I don't think they will solve the problem. And even should, I would suggest strongly that anyone should stop selling cash tickets and charging cash handling fees to the public, and deal with the current situation until it is clear. Then they can deal with new passengers and new planes and, you know, their new destinations and schedules.
That was retired public servant and Port Moresby resident Mensa Wagoon speaking there with the ABC's Hilda Wayne. And the ABC has sought comment from Air New Guinea. Switching to sport now, and the year 2026 could prove to be a landmark for rugby league in the Pacific, with the organisation behind the Auckland-based bid to establish a Polynesian-owned club in the NRL set to step up their campaign. With a fresh round of TV rights negotiations set to begin in 2027, the Mana Pacifica bid team believe they can play a key role in helping the NRL to secure a bigger deal if they are granted a licence. On the field, they say they have a big-name coach ready to go, and connections with a raft of Pacifica players who would be keen to be part of their squad. And now, as Richard Hewitt reports, Air New Zealand's hip-hop icon King Kapisi has come on board to promote the bid, which he views as the start of a cultural movement to celebrate and solidify the Pacific's role in rugby league's future.
Boys to raise up, cause we tell the roof off and rip the stage up. When we rock, y'all, it goes on and on. It's non-stop, y'all, it goes on and on.
Yeah, I've played in each city, I've played all over Australia multiple times over the last 30 years. So I'm able to talk to mayors, talk to MPs. Having the profile that I have, most of the people at some stage in the last 30 years have listened to my music. So, you know, I have a certain influence now. And the thing with my music, I still haven't stopped. And we've done other things at a clothing label, started my charitable trust. So I'm very community orientated.
A leading figure on the New Zealand music scene for many years, King Kapisi is passionate about his Samoan roots and passionate about helping to establish an NRL franchise that will create pathways for young Polynesians. And the director of the Mana Pacifica bid, Jeff Mulianga Brown, says Kapisi's involvement is a huge boost to their campaign.
King Kapisi has been in the industry for over 30 years, and he was one of the first Polynesian artists to break into Australian market. When it comes to the challenges we're facing, he brings that mindset that, you know, it's achievable. These things are important to our people. The biggest thing he said to me was, how are these kids supposed to identify if we can't even see our own people being part of the leadership of a club? We want to encourage our kids to have careers in the NRL. Why can't they be CEOs? Why can't they be the head of recruitment? 60% of Polynesians are now playing in the NRL. No Polynesian owns a team.
So clearly there is much more to the Mana Pacifica bid than putting a team together. If the bid is successful, then the intention is for the club to be Pacifica owned and run. And Director Brown believes if the NRL gives them the nod sooner rather than later, their presence will be financially beneficial for the league right from the start.
It's already been recommended that they get 20 teams. Our position, we're very strong. We've got a lot of good people around us. We're talking to investors. We haven't gone to government for support, but we've got island nations backing the bid, but we're also talking to private sector. We're talking to people that actually run global businesses. The NRL, they want to grow their audience. To grow the audience, you need more money. And right now with the TV rights, which they negotiate in 2027, that's when they've got to finalise a deal.
We have two other bids here, and, you know, I wish them all the best, but I think that we've done our due diligence by, you know, locking in places like Eden Park, the Cape Town, other places down here in the South Island where I am now, but also being able to talk to governments back home in the Pacific Islands and being able to actually ask them, would you guys like to have some games there? And so, you know, we're looking pretty good. We've got a whole bunch of players that are willing to come in from Matumatonga all the way down to the under 17, under 16 ranges. So finding teams for our men and one for our ladies won't be a hard thing.
Right now, the Mana Pacifica bid team can't be sure where they stand with the NRL, and the timeline for a decision is not clear, but they have a well-connected advisor who is tapping into the vibe at NRL HQ.
He's been working with us, but also working with the NRL. And he's former COO of the NRL. He's been involved with us from the start. So we've been getting feedback from him in regards to what the NRL are doing. I think the big difference with us, we're a bit more current. We're not guessing on coaches. We have a coach. And if we announce the coach today, it'll turn a lot of heads. And I've been involved in junior development programs across New Zealand and the Pacific for 15 years. 30% of my players are now playing in the NRL. 30% of them. And our NRL players through our systems and through our pathways. We're not going to struggle to put teams together. We've said that from the start.
While no one knows in which direction the NRL will eventually decide to go or when, Jeff Brown says his organisation are already on the start line and planning for their debut season as the second club in New Zealand's most populous city.
We're actually working like we're getting ready for 2028. And it's not something we just come out of the woodworks like all the other bids that are out there. We're current. We know the marketplace. We're working with high-level individuals. You know, we've got the mayor's back in it, stadium back in it. Actually, we have multiple stadiums back in the bid. About 300,000 to 400,000 Polynesian people living in Auckland. And I was asked the other day, why do we need another team? And I went, well, Sydney has nine teams. I don't know why we're questioning Auckland when Sydney has nine teams and we have one.
And if Mana Pacifica succeed, as everyone involved clearly believes they will, then King Kapisi has another important role he wants to play.
If anyone's going to create an anthem for the Mana, it's going to be me. And so, you know, I've had ideas, throwing beats around and all that type of thing. So I'm consistently making reggae music, making dance music, making drum and bass music, making rap music. So the music thing, you know, I can do that with my eyes closed these days. I've been doing it for a long time and I've mastered my skill, and I've also become good at marketing, and that's the skills that I bring to Mana Pacifica.
Hip-hop star King Kapisi, a man on a mission who I suspect won't stop until he's helped to secure a place for Mana Pacifica in the NRL alongside the PNG Chiefs. And the reporter there was Richard Hewitt. It is Tuesday, December 23, and you're listening to Pacific Beat on ABC Radio Australia. I'm Kyle Evans, and if you're just tuning in, the US has listed Tonga among 39 countries whose nationals will either be banned or partially banned from being granted visas to enter the United States. And speaking of travel pain, it's been a chaotic festive season for air travellers in Papua New Guinea, with delayed flights disrupting travel plans, forcing passengers to sleep at the domestic terminal in Port Moresby.
Passengers decided to sleep inside the check-in area, not outside anymore. So women and children and everyone who are traveling, lying all, you know, hungry, starving, and it's almost very stressful for them.
Yeah, pretty sorry stuff. Stay tuned, because up next we are going to take a look at how Pacific Island states are getting caught up in shipping shadow fleets. Welcome back to Pacific Beat, to the high seas now, where Pacific Island nations are increasingly finding themselves associated with so-called shadow fleets, which are being used to transport black market oil. New figures show there's more than 100 dark fleet ships currently sailing under Pacific Nation flags, 49 from Palau, 27 from Marshall Islands, and 22 from the Cook Islands. The ships, which are often poor, which are often old and poorly maintained, are often linked to the transport of Russian crude oil, which is used to fund its illegal invasion of Ukraine. To find out more, I'm joined by an expert associate at the Australian National University's National Security College, Jen Parker. Jen, welcome back to the program.
Thanks for having me on.
Not a problem at all. Now, let's start, I guess, at the beginning. Who is behind these shadow fleets and how do they operate?
Well, it's not really one entity behind these shadow fleets. It's more of a maritime ecosystem that has kind of evolved with kind of state-linked, specifically oil exporters in the case of sanctions, trying to evade these sanctions. That tends to be Russia, Iran, Venezuela, North Korea as well, in terms of sanctions on them for nuclear weapons development. That is supported by a web of kind of private enablers. So traders, commodity brokers, ship owners, ship managers, operators, etc., who go down this path of financing and supporting this shadow fleet. And then finally, the third kind of cog in that wheel that supports this is countries that have open registries that are obviously called, often called flags of convenience, where they will register, so flag a vessel to them, but they have no genuine connection and don't ensure that that vessel supports IMO, International Maritime Organization regulation. So it's kind of this ecosystem. And really what shadow fleets or dark fleets are, they're these kind of ships that operate outside of normal international regulations, whether that is safety regulations or labour regulations or regulations about the fact that you need to tell people where you are when you're at sea. So that's kind of who's behind it and how they operate. These vessels too, these shadow fleet vessels, tend to be quite dangerous. So they often tend to be quite old. So in fact, there's some numbers that say about 60% of the shadow fleet that supports Russia's evasion of oil sanctions are actually over 15 years old. And one of the issues with that is older tankers, especially ones on open registries where the flag state or the registry state isn't making sure that they're complying with classification or insurance, so they have the right safety standards and maintenance, they tend to be a lot more prone to accidents, oil spills, and those kind of issues.
Yeah, it's pretty concerning stuff. Let's talk about these ship registries, because many of these tankers are sailing under Pacific flags. How are so many of these vessels managing to get registered? And how are Pacific Island nations, you know, getting caught up in their activities?
Well, it really starts with the way the oceans are managed. So the way the oceans are managed, there's the UN Convention on the Law of the Sea, which is generally the constitution of the ocean. Now, that establishes that effectively flag states or the registry of a ship have primacy over that ship, and they also have the responsibilities for ensuring that ship complies with the IMO, International Maritime Organization regulations that I mentioned before. Now, that requires there to be a genuine linkage between the ship that registers, sorry, the country that registers a vessel and the ship. But over time, that has eroded, and we've seen this development of what's called open registries. And there are at least five, I think maybe a couple more, open registries in the Pacific. Now, these are registries that are set up for commercial purposes. So a country will choose to register a vessel, but it has no linkage to the ownership of that vessel to that country. And a good example is kind of the Cook Islands right now. So the Cook Islands was determined to, in December, have about 20 sanctioned vessels under US sanctions on their registry and about 15 under the British sanctions list. So there's no genuine connection between the state and that ship. It becomes a commercial transaction. And what we see with these shadow fleets is, to avoid being caught up in sanctions or held accountable for their behaviour, these ships will chop registries and they'll move to countries who are not going to pay much attention to, is that ship dodgy? What is it doing? Is it on a sanctions list? Has it been breaching IMO regulations? Is it breaching labour regulations? So often Pacific countries, because they have limited ability, because their population size, their budget size, to really enforce these rules on these ships or really do due diligence onto what are the ships they're registering, they're often seen as targets for these dodgy vessels to register with those flag states.
Well, yeah, and as a result, as we saw with Cook Islands, it was about 12 months ago, where it was their flag that was flying on a ship that ended up getting seized in the Baltic Sea for allegedly severing a communications cable, if I recall correctly. I mean, with that example in mind, are Pacific nations potentially, like, could they potentially find themselves liable or risk reputational damage if their flag is associated with some of these ships, particularly if they go on to, you know, cause maritime incidents or disasters?
Yeah, so they definitely can find themselves liable. So you're right, the Eagle-S was a flag to the Cook Islands. It was arrested by Finland in late 24 and accused of cutting a series of seabed cables. And an important thing to know, that these shadow fleets don't just support sanctions busting. They also often create maritime security issues. So there's been allegations of attacking maritime infrastructure, environmental issues, et cetera, but in terms of liability of Pacific Islands that choose to register these vessels, yes. So there is very clearly reputational risk. And what happens with that is if a country is seen to be flagging these vessels that don't comply with IMO regulations, that create safety and environmental risks and bust sanctions, then you might find that other ports won't allow vessels flagged to that country in anymore, or insurers might refuse to work with that registry. So there's kind of that reputational risk. From a legal risk, absolutely, because as I mentioned, under the UN Convention of the Law of the Sea, it is flag states that are responsible for ensuring that their vessels comply with IMO regulations. So even though there's no real connection between the vessel and the flag state, under international law, there is a linkage there and they're responsible. And what you find with a lot of these shadow vessels is they're often not correctly insured, or they're set up by a series of shell companies, so their owner isn't clear. So when they have an incident, so specifically, you know, an environmental incident, for example, and there's been a number around the world that have been attributed to shadow fleets, then if they can't find out who owns that vessel, or if that vessel doesn't have insurance, then they could actually come after the flag state legally and require them to pay to clean it up. Now, there's not a lot of examples of that happening, but it could happen. So really, these Pacific Islands that create open registries and flag these shadow vessels are opening themselves not only to reputational risk, but also legal risk and commercial risk in terms of countries may stop allowing vessels flagged to them to go into their ports.
Yeah, it's super interesting. It kind of leads me into my next question. It seems to me, and this is just judging from what I've seen online in YouTube videos and things like that, many of these ships kind of seem to operate in plain sight. What prevents authorities from monitoring them or regulating their activity? And I guess by an extension of that, what stops Pacific Island ship registries from being able to properly monitor them so they can deregister them, I guess?
Look, this is a really great question. And I think that, you know, with everybody having access to Google Maps and things like Marine Tracker, we seem to think that we live in a world where we know where everything is at every time. But actually, when it comes to the oceans, that's not the case. So, you know, 70% of the world is ocean, and it's really hard to track what is happening across those oceans. What makes it harder with these shadow fleets? One, they often don't use AIS. So every ship above a certain size, and certainly all these tankers, have to use the automatic identification system under the International Maritime Organization's regulations. But most of them turn it off, or they'll fake their position. So, for example, one of the ships seized by the US over the weekend was saying that it was at sea off Guyana when it was, in fact, alongside in Venezuela. The second element is they often change their flags of registration. They often change their names or paint over their names or put fake names in their AIS system or fake destinations. And then they often have kind of opaque ownership where it's hard to work out who actually owns them. Now, working out that ships are doing these things can be quite labour intensive or admin intensive. So for small registries that don't have that support, it can be quite difficult to understand what is the ship and who owns it that you've registered and what is it actually doing.
Yeah, well, it is super interesting, and it does sound like a real minefield to navigate. Just touching on what you said before about how these ships are quite old and poorly maintained, do they pose potential environmental risks at all?
So they pose significant environmental risks. One, because, as I said, the lack of maintenance. Two, because of the fact that they often go around the oceans without having their location, so their AIS on, which means that there have been a number of collisions where ships didn't detect them and then collided with other ships. Politico actually has a report out that says that they have managed to detect at least 13 massive oil slicks by satellite technology where shadow fleet vessels have spilled oil over the side. In fact, there's an example off Scotland in early 24 where they found a 23-kilometre oil slick that had been left by a shadow fleet vessel. And these things cause huge impacts to coastal communities, especially coastal communities that are dependent on fishing. And what makes that more complicated is because these shadow fleets often aren't insured or properly insured, or you can't work out who the owner is, then it often becomes the coastal community who's responsible for paying for that cleanup.
Yeah, and we've seen that in recent weeks and months, what the damage that oil can do to coastal communities, particularly in places like Micronesia, where there's lots of, you know, World War II shipwrecks and things like that. Just finally, Jen, because we are running out of time, you know, given the revenue and the oil from a lot of these dark fleets actually go on to, well, it's believed they go on to fund nefarious activities such as, you know, the Ukraine war and things like that. And with that, you know, I think comes some serious reputational damage for Pacific Island nations. How can they better protect themselves going forward? Like, is there anything they can do, or are they just, you know, too small and under-resourced?
So, look, you're right. It is serious reputational damage, and not just because the movements of these ships are funding, you know, Russia's illegal war in Ukraine. They're funding, Iranian-backed proxies that are supporting terrorism in the Middle East and all sorts of other things around the world that are causing huge instability. I guess from a small state perspective, look, association with these ships really does matter. And we've seen, you know, the Cook Islands come under some criticism early this year for this point. I think really these small islands need to be looking at, one, how do they manage their open registry? Two, can they get support? So the IMO is offering support to actually help clean up registries. Three, are they working with countries that have more ability to know what these ships are doing? And then four, are they deregistering these ships when it becomes clear that they are either, you know, supporting busting of sanctions, or they are unsafe, or they don't have clear ownership, or they don't have insurance? So all of that really, it means doing due diligence and working with organisations like the IMO that can help flag states do due diligence. But in the end, to protect their reputation, small islands need to be removing these ships from their registry when they find that they are busting sanctions or unsafe, etc.
Well, I hope they're listening to this interview. I know I've tried to speak with Maritime Cook Islands in the past about this issue without success, but now hopefully something can be done, because I do think it's a pretty massive issue that could potentially get worse going forward. Jen, that's all we've got time for, but great insight as always, and thank you very much for joining us on Pacific Beat today.
Thanks so much.
Not a problem at all. That was Jennifer Parker from the Australian National University's National Security College.
Join Sosair Fo'amoli every Tuesday afternoon for Sister Sounds, a music show dedicated to showcasing the breadth of talented female musicians and performers from across the Pacific on ABC Radio Australia. Sister Sounds will bring you amazing local talent mixed with the sounds and vibe you'll love by artists from across the seas as well. Tune in to Sister Sounds, Tuesday afternoon at 3 PNG time on ABC Radio Australia.
Welcome back to Pacific Beat. Well, last weekend, the Vanuatu DJ Festival returned, not just a music festival, but as a youth-led community initiative. Young people took ownership, organising, securing and running the event while providing entertainment services and care for their own neighbourhood. One of the event organisers, Milroy Cainton, told the ABC's Lily Rose Wellwell, the festival is a demonstration of creativity, leadership and hope, showing how youth can transform challenges into opportunities.
DJ Fest is a platform for youth to unleash their creativity, their unity, and their passion and love for music. Singing and playing an instrument is not the only part in the entertainment industry. People go to parties, people go to birthday parties, to a wedding, to nightclubs, and to any sort of event. In Vanuatu, we get used to putting in on a playlist. If you want to host an event, instead of playing some music, you have to also engage a DJ. DJ should become entrepreneur. All the youths can come together. They run the show. They do the DJ. They provide security. They look after the stalls. They collect the money. They do bookkeeping. They do planning. They do the cleaning. Everything, 100%, is done by these young people. The festival stops at 3 a.m. in the morning, and the youths were cleaning up
The Fatu Mauru Park at 3 a.m. Think about that. Next day is cruise ship. When the cruise ship arrives in the morning at 6 a.m., the entire Fatu Mauru Park, which is located close to popular CBD, is fully clean and ready to receive cruise ship. The funds used raised during the event will go towards the hospital cast.
Is it because of the issues that people are facing with having access to CAS when they have asthma?
Asthma is a big problem. So there is rise of asthma. And by us providing some small funds for the thing, I think the community gonna benefit from it. The funds is raised by the community and it's going to benefit the community, I guess. So we believe in community. We are happy. The youth are happy, the community is happy. That's success. Which by the amount of money we make, we define success by how many people are happy and impacted.
That's a beautiful story. Festival organizer Milroy Cainton speaking there to the ABC's Lily Rose Well. Welcome back to Pacific Beat. Well, a Nauruan woman has released her first book titled You Can Count to 10 in Nauruan. Entrepreneur and author Taylor Bond wrote the novel using a mix of English and Nauruan language with the illustrations done by a Micronesian woman from Guam. She told Lucy Cooper, now that she lives in Australia, it was an opportunity to give back to her community.
Growing up in Nauru, we've never had basic learning books, whether it's for counting, colours, anything like that. And for me, being so close to my Nauruan community, even while living in Australia, and one day wanting to plan my own family, or even just seeing like my nieces and my nephews grow up without one, I really did want to do something about it. Because, you know, as we all know, language, it's only really valued once it starts to fade.
Is there other children's books in Nauruan language or from a Nauruan author that's for kids?
So there is none. In the past, they have some legends that have been made, but that's just a piece of paper with the story on it. And, you know, a lot of storytelling has just been told by through word of mouth and talking to, you know, your friends and your family or the older generations telling you bedtime stories. So this is, I'd like to say and be proud to say that it is the first Nauruan kids children's books.
How important is it to have something like this in a time when we know that many kids in the Pacific may not see out their entire lives there because where they live is threatened by climate change?
With climate change, it is forcing people to relocate. And our heritage language often naturally becomes secondary to the dominant language in that country, whether it's, well, you know, you need to use it for survival, school, work. Naturally, when, you know, your mother tongue becomes optional rather than necessary, our language naturally will fade. But for this book, I guess it's a love letter to the Nauruan children that they can learn their language wherever they are growing up from.
Kids in Nauru, what do you hope that they get out of this or their reactions might be to seeing and reading this book?
They've never been able to 100% relate to a children's book, to be able to see the locations and know that this is where they're growing up. And I hope that it can, if it can, even if it just at least helps one child feel connected to their language, then I believe I've done what I wanted to do, and just to help preserve it as well.
Do you think that the Nauruan government would be keen to get this in classrooms?
The intention for me, that's quite an interesting question, because the Nauru language is very diverse. And there's a lot of differing opinions because, so although my book wasn't, the main mission wasn't to get it through the curriculum, if they would like to, I'd love that. But because of the different colonizations that have occupied Nauru throughout the years, the Nauruan, like whether it's German, English, Japanese, the Nauruan language, and even just having been interacted with other Pacific Island nations as well, the Nauruan language is very diverse, and there is a fine line whether you want to stick to the traditional Nauruan language that can, say, be seen in our Bible, or where we still use the tilde above, like, say, our letters, or others believe that they would want to go the other way when the Australian government made a gazette around 1938 to change it. It's very hit and miss. It's not necessarily for the curriculum, but the government can still support it in whether it's still, you know, just on a bookshelf in the library. But I do know that the Nauruan government is also, after many, many years, for those issues that I've explained before, they are starting to reintroduce the Nauruan language into our curricula. So we'll see how that goes.
Taylor Bond, who has just released her first book, You Can Count to 10 in Nauruan. And that does bring us to the end of Pacific Beats. Recapping our top story, it's been a chaotic festive season for air travellers in Papua New Guinea, with delayed flights disrupting travel plans, forcing passengers to sleep at the domestic terminal in Port Moresby.
Women and children and everyone who are travelling, lying all, you know, hungry, starving, and it was very stressful for them.
As retired public servant and Port Moresby resident Mensa Wagoon speaking there. I'll be back at the same time tomorrow. That's 6 a.m. PNG time. You can also hear us again this afternoon at 5 p.m. PNG time. That'll be with Richard Hewitt. Stay tuned though on ABC Radio Australia because the news is next. And coming up after that is Nisha Daily. You'll find all our top stories on our website. Just type Pacific Beat and Radio Australia into your search engine. My name's Kyle Evans. Have a fantastic day.